Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood, as in go ahead, make my news. So visit there, please, and go ahead, start up a $5 a month donation today and support the alternative media. My very special guest coming at us live is Bruce Maccabee. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's fantastic to have you. Now, I would really love it if you'd explain just a little bit about who you are and what you do for this segment.
Well, I'm a retired Navy physicist for the U.S. Navy. I spent 36 years doing various science research jobs for the Navy. Way back in the 60s, when I was working for my PhD at American University in Washington, D.C., I became interested in the subject of UFOs, and in the 70s started doing independent research and analyzing a number of cases and so on, one of which happened to be the December 1978 New Zealand sightings off the Kaikoura Coast, and I've continued investigating sightings since then. One of them that's most famous probably is the Japan Airlines 1628 jumbo jet over Alaska sightings. The most important present situation is I just published a book called the FBI-CIA UFO Connection, which is based on unquestionably authentic government documents which show, have evidence that the top Air Force officials and perhaps probably others in the government back in the late 40s and early 50s had already concluded that UFOs were interplanetary. They just didn't tell anybody. They tried to poo-poo the whole thing for it. And that's the situation that we're in right now, that the government officially, the U.S. government officially says there's nothing to it, and if you try to make a report to the government, they tell you to go away and make a report to the Mutual UFO Network or something like that.
The flying disc runaround.
What?
They give you with the old flying disc runaround routine.
Well, basically they say there's no evidence that they have investigated which points towards interplanetary or ET, or whatever you want to call it. They would say that all sightings could be explained as misidentifications, hoaxes, or delusions. And what I'm saying in this book is by analyzing the government documents that are available now, which weren't available 60 years ago, you can find evidence that the top Air Force officials had already concluded by 1952 that UFOs, or at least some things people report in the sky, unidentified flying objects, some of them appear to be interplanetary or ET spaceships or whatever you want to call it.
Can I ask, how do you think they made that conclusion?
Well, they studied sightings, right? This UFO phenomenon sort of began on June 24th, 1947, with Kenneth Arnold's sighting near Mount Rainier. And within a few weeks, there had been hundreds of sightings from other places in the United States and some other places in the world. And many of the witnesses were Air Force pilots. And so they set up a project to investigate, which turned out to be called Project Sign, and concluded in Project Sign of these things, some of the sightings were interplanetary, and that was based on, well, these were the experts in aeronautical engineering who were doing these analyses. And in 1952, during the big flap of sightings that happened over the Washington, D.C. area and really throughout the whole United States in June, July, and August of 1952, on the same day that General John A. Samford, the head of Air Force Intelligence, gave a press conference in Washington, D.C. to explain all the sightings on that same day, July 29th, 1952. the FBI was told by a person who worked in the Air Force Intelligence Office, the FBI was told that top Air Force officials are seriously considering interplanetary ships as an explanation for some of the sightings. The hardest ones to explain, 2 or 3% of the sightings of which there was no theory they could explain in conventional terms.
What was the military's response to this? Because in my studies of history, whenever the military experiences a new weapon or a new piece of technology that they haven't seen before, they often start developing weapons and technology of their own to counteract it or defend against it or compete against it. Do you believe the U.S. government has been developing advanced aircraft and things of that nature based upon these sightings?
I don't have any evidence that they developed anything based on the sightings. There are claims of what might be called technology transfer. Assuming that, for example, if there really was a crash at Roswell, we might have figured out some of the stuff that's involved. But it's been my own opinion that whatever's flying around out there is so far ahead of us we can barely understand it. I don't think we've developed any effective defense against what are commonly in the old days called flying saucers.
The poet Robert Frost said there's either two possibilities. One, we're completely alone in the universe, or two, we're not. And both prospects are terrifying to me.
Yep.
How do you think that this actually affects how we look at the world? I mean, if you're saying that, yes, there's UFOs, yes, they're from another planet, and no, we have absolutely no way of defending against them if they chose to get hostile, is that a conclusion that you're driving with? Or?
Yeah, first of all, you have to reach the conclusion that there is some fraction of UFO sightings which are unexplainable in conventional means. And then, given that, you take those particular sightings and analyze the heck out of what the information is that the witness has. Sometimes you get more than just a witness testimony. Sometimes you get photos or film or magnetic detections or something. And the New Zealand sightings of December 31st, 1978, you had multiple witness sightings of people on the airplane. It was traveling from Wellington south to Christchurch in the middle of the night carrying newspapers. You also had a news crew on board the airplane, oddly enough. You got color movie film, and there was airplane radar and ground radar, all involved over the period of about 2 hours that these sightings occurred. I concluded from that there was really something going on that couldn't be explained.
Well, just because it's unexplained, I mean, I was thinking about military classified aircraft, like many aircraft, even from B-2 bombers, F-117 Nighthawks. They were kind of referred to as sort of like conspiracy theories and things of that nature before the government actually released the technology. But in your experience being an old Navy man, you say that there's absolutely no possibility that they could make anything like a flying saucer in a classified facility somewhere with unlimited resources.
Well, you say anything like a flying saucer. I don't think they've duplicated flying saucer technology. They might be able to make something that looks like it, but, you know, the classic shape of being a circular object with a dome in the center or something like that. I don't think they have anything shaped like that that can fly and hover and take off at high speed so fast sometimes that the thing seems to disappear.
I'm not
saying that there's no technology anywhere that hasn't been developed based on flying saucers. Oddly enough, there's a document, and it comes from early 1949, in which a guy who worked for a program called the Nuclear Energy for the Propulsion of Aircraft, NEPA project. The NEPA project was, he says, given impetus by the presence of green fireballs and flying saucers. And he said this to the FBI.
What I find interesting is that people who deny the existence of UFOs, and even the title itself, don't you think it's a little bit disingenuous? Oh, it's just an unidentified flying object. I mean, have we been able to identify anything of any kind about these things so as to mean that we don't have to use the UFO terminology anymore? Has there been any of these flying objects that are actually identified?
Well, some people may know a lot more about them than I do, and things like where they came from and why they're here. That may be knowledge that's available in a top secret compartmentalized type of knowledge. I would suspect it would be a government contractor rather than the government itself running the project. I spent 15 years visiting the CIA as a result of the work that I was doing in the Navy on laser-generated underwater sound. I put this for the first time into my book. It's published for the first time. In this book, I was talking about the FBI-CIA UFO connection, and I got to know what was going on in the CIA pretty well. And
could you elucidate on
that? I wasn't able to identify any evidence that the CIA was running a big project. That doesn't mean there wasn't one somewhere off to the side. As I said, in a government contractor. And I'm sure there are people who know a lot more about the UFOs themselves than I do. But significant that I've been able to provide evidence that the government knew about, the Air Force knew that these things were far beyond us, interplanetary, to use their terminology. And I think the government knew this way back in 1948 and 49.
And why haven't they released that information to the public?
Well, you'd have to ask. Well, first of all, that information has been released now. Freedom of Information Act requests and just plain government declassification of documents has resulted in a lot of information being available. Starting in the middle 80s and going up until the present time, documents are being released. But back at the time they were this is happening, back in the late 40s and early 50s, the Air Force wasn't telling anybody anything. The Air Force didn't say anything positive about the subject. They basically said, we're investigating, we're not finding anything, which was essentially a lie. And when General John A. Samford, at his press conference on July 29th, tried to explain everything away, all hundreds of sightings in the United States, some of which are published in the book, when he tried to explain to the general public and the press soaked it up, you might say, that as far as he was concerned, everything was natural phenomena. As I pointed out earlier, somebody in his office of the Air Force Intelligence told an FBI agent that, oh, by the way, interplanetary is being considered as a possible explanation.
It's just being floated as a possible explanation. They honestly don't know. Why the secrecy?
There's another document mentioned in my book that most people don't know about by a guy who later on became the conceptual father of the Strategic Defense Initiative, a guy by the name of Stephen Possoni. And he wrote in the document that the Air Force cannot assume that flying saucers are interplanetary. And the key word here is assume. The way he writes this document, and it means that the top Air Force officials that he was writing this document for assumed that flying saucers were interplanetary. In other words, they knew it by 1952.
But of course they're not making a big public ordeal about this. Oh, by the way, we just assume there's aliens and assume that these flying aircraft are completely outside of our control and we can't resist them even if we tried, because goodness knows what kind of technology they'd get. I mean, there's pretty obvious reasons why they wouldn't tell that, you know, blatantly to the public and repeat it in mainstream media 1,000 times a day, isn't there?
Well, they wouldn't want to have the general public realize that there are things flying around that the Air Force can't do anything about.
Well, a lot of people believe this already, and what are they? Are they freaking out about it or anything? I think if these aliens aren't really doing anything bad or whatever, and they're just flying around, are there any speculations into government documents as to why they're actually coming here? Because I was researching this a little bit, and apparently there is a significantly higher percentage of abduction stories in the continental U.S. than anywhere else on Earth. Have you heard that?
Well, I'm not familiar with the statistics of the distribution throughout the world of abduction stories. I wouldn't be surprised. I think starting in the early 60s with the so-called first cases, the most important one being the Betty and Barney Hill case, the idea of abduction grew through the 1970s, and then by the 1980s, there are a lot of cases on record of people claiming to have been abducted, or these abductions. Initially, a lot of the people remembered UFO sightings, but they had the situation of missing time, and it required hypnosis to figure out what the missing time situation was. But the abduction stories are probably the only source we have of information, something from the abduction stories as to what they're doing around here. My own feeling is the theory of hybridization and assimilation, where they get assimilated into our society, seems reasonable based on what I know. But there are other.
Are you talking about like a genetic infiltration of human DNA so that they can? That whatever off-world creatures can make themselves look like us, kind of thing.
That could be. I mean, I'm not nailed down to any one explanation. but I did investigate sightings in Gulf Breeze, Florida, and the chief person there, the one who was took all the pictures, was evidently an abductee, and what he told me implied that he was being used as a example of human reaction to various situations that a human being might find himself in. And in his stories where he would be put into a situation, and then after it was all over and he had done some reaction to whatever the situation was, then he would be sort of connected up with a headgear. And in some room, he would be sitting in a table or something with his headgear attached. And then some creatures would come in, some little ones and one big one would come in, and they put headgear on the little ones. And then all of a sudden, he'd find himself reliving whatever the experience was that he had had earlier. So it looked like he was doing some sort of teaching of the little ones how to react to situations. I know it sounds bizarre, but it takes quite a while to be sufficiently detailed in these descriptions to
I look at it like if a rat got released from a lab and he said, "Hey, dude, it was these really, really massive creatures with these huge white suits on and stuff like that, and they had like face masks and glasses over, and they had all this really advanced technology, and they put me in a maze, bro. They got me to run around and stuff, and they fed me really good cheese, and I don't know what the hell they were talking about or what they were doing, but now I've got this massive tumor." You know, and the other rats would just go, "Bro, you're crazy. You know, you've been chewing on the power cables again, haven't you?"
Yeah, well, that's not too far from what the implication would be of this man's experiences.
And so, I think it's like if we're a lower organism to these creatures, of course, their intentions and whatever technology they've got would be, of course, incomprehensible to us, wouldn't they? Because we wouldn't know what we were looking at from what scale.
like Arthur C. Clarke's comment about sufficiently advanced technology appears to be magic.
Precisely. Now, I was just thinking about this. Wernher von Braun, he said that there would be three wars that would change humanity and usher us into a new world order. The first would be the Second World War, the second would be a global war on terrorism, and the third would be an alien invasion. And he said that they'd be working on maybe staging an alien invasion. And I was always wondering, kind of curious, like, are there human beings, elements in the government or something like that? I wonder what the possibility is that there are actually really, really bad people on Earth right now that are working with really, really nasty alien scum from across the stars, trying to work out some kind of agenda to enslave the rest of the human race.
Well, I don't know. And it may be that way back as far as the late 40s and early 50s, the government did know something about these interplanetary craft and the creatures on the inside, which made the government people or whoever knew had this information say, we better not tell anybody because this could be detrimental to civilization. At the very least, realization that UFOs, quote, UFOs are real, unquote, which is a sort of a generic, non-specific term, I should really say AFCs, alien flying craft, are real. And knowing that that's true can have an impact, especially if it's known that that's true and abductions take place, because that means there's some sort of direct interaction between them and us. And at the very least, that introduces a new uncertainty into civilization, which already has enough uncertainty. And uncertainty in civilization is detrimental to the continuation of civilization, especially if uncertainty is something like they can grab you at any time and do anything they want to you. We all hear about the references to probes of various types being inserted in various places.
You see, well, and, the thing is, to me, that doesn't have to involve an alien, you know, if you've ever lived in Soviet Russia or something like that, a commissar or a gulag or something of that nature, they can grab you at any time. They can come and get you. It's almost like there's a similar behavioral pattern to tyrannical governments and scumbaggery within the human condition as to how a lot of alleged alien reports come out, you know, dark, shadowy, don't care about you, scare the hell out of your family and make you live in fear.
Yeah, well, things can happen caused by human beings. And I've often said, if I had to choose between being abducted by humans and abducted by aliens, I'd pick the aliens.
I mean, that'd at least be a lot more fun.
yeah.
Hey, speaking of which, I have a joke for you. Do you know how aliens repair their damaged spacecraft?
No.
With abduct tape.
Abduct tape? Oh, yeah. My goodness. I can just see a big roll of abduct tape coming down from high up above and sticking onto somebody, and then they get pulled up by this very strong abduct tape.
Yeah, they snare them. All right, well, Bruce, it's been really wonderful chatting with you, and we've got about a minute left in the segment. Would you be able to rattle off your website, any other places where perhaps...
yes.
Objects where someone can get your book.
Do check up on www.brumac.8k. That's the number 8, letter K, .com. Rumac.8k.com. Or simply Google on Bruce Maccabee and you'll get to my website. And from there you can scroll down a little ways and you'll find links to get the book from Amazon. It's doing very well. And you can find 100 megabytes or more of other cases, analyses that I looked at, like the Battle of Los Angeles and New Zealand and Japan Airlines, and it'd take me a while just to list the number of cases that I've got detailed analyses on my website.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening up. Tune in right after the break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Make sure that you go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and check out our sponsors at the bottom of the page there, including Blue Shield to protect yourself from that nasty EMF radiation. I'm not sure if it'll protect you from a duct tape. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the listener-supported broadcast where you, the listener, can actually, you know, donate to keep it on the air and whatnot. My very special guests joining me now are Jerry and Kathy Wills. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Vinnie. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Now, you guys have started a new network and doing a whole bunch of things, as you always do. So could you just give us a wee bit of an update about what you guys have been happening?
Yeah, of course. Well, what we did recently, we started a new network called Channel U. And it's at channel-u.com. And basically, the idea that started this was sprung from the concept that we wanted to be our own independent broadcasters, not really affiliated with any other service. A lot of times these services charge you money, and sometimes they can be undependable. And then you have limitations, and we didn't want any limitations. We wanted to just do it ourselves. So we investigated how it's done, and within a couple of weeks we had a server up and outfitted and ready to broadcast. And it's been kind of on autopilot off and on. We do our own shows, of course, on Friday nights. But aside from that, we've just got it up and running, and we're just now starting to populate it.
And what's your objective here? I mean, are you wanting to create like a full-on network, producing shows live, that kind of thing?
Yeah, live and archived. We have friends, people that we know who have really interesting shows, like yourself. And we felt that, you know, we do have an audience. We have an audience all over the world. I was the associate host for the Kevin Smith Show for a few years. And with Expeditions TV and all that we're doing, we have people all over the world who are interested. So we figured if we did this, then we would see if some of our friends wanted to come in and just broadcast their shows on there too, you know, just as a service.
And what actually motivated you to really like kind of jump the chasm and go ahead and start doing this? I mean, it must have been on your mind for quite a while.
You know, after Kevin passed away a couple of years ago, I really felt a void. I liked being on the radio. I liked doing this kind of thing. But I didn't have the inclination to do it, because it is a lot of work. And the way Kevin did it was 5 nights a week, 2 hours every night, required a huge amount of time and effort, which I just didn't have. So I decided eventually that I'd like to do a show, and it really just led to this. We did a show on another network for a while, and I got used to it. I started really enjoying it. And there were issues. So I thought, you know, I'll just do this myself. If there are any issues, it's because of me, not because of anything beyond these walls. And that's how we started it.
I'd like to also see what you guys are up to just in your general career, because last time I had you on was in 2013, and we were talking about these stargates and ley lines and your experiences with those. I mean, are there any documentaries in the works or new stuff that you've got happening?
Actually, there is. Last year, we were down in South America. We had wanted to go down for quite a number of years to document this thing that we had found in the year 2000. It's something we call the Doomsday Stone. It's not what the locals call it. They don't know what to call it. It's just a piece of rock sticking out of the top of a mountain. But it had these really odd petroglyphs on it. And the more we studied it over the 13 years, the more we came to realize there was really a story there. So we wanted to go back and document the story of finding it and so forth. Well, we didn't know at the time, and until 13 years later, it became a very poignant thing for us to go after, was that something happened to the Earth, like 1,500 years ago, roughly. And it was a hell of a story. It was something that changed the course of civilization. So this stone seemed to link itself to these events that took place. And what I'm talking about here is a celestial event. It was a comet that passed close to the Earth. So when we started putting what was on this stone, the hieroglyphs on this stone, to those events, they seemed to match up. Kathy did a lot more research and started finding other very strange, anomalous things that happened at about the same time that had never been associated with this thing that had happened in Europe. So the story began to unfold. We went down, spent 45 days, and during that time we completely documented, of course, the Doomsday Stone. And then we went on to Bolivia, where we'd been following a story for about 5 years about a human footprint that had been found, and it was very obscure. No one knew really where it was at, and at least no one was talking. It was a closely held secret. One afternoon, while we were really hiding out in the jungle after some encounters with the Shining Path and narco-traffickers, we were kind of laying low. That's a story in itself. But she was doing her research, and she came across an obscure passage in a blog in Portugal about this footprint, and it spelled out pretty much where to go looking for it. So we took off to Bolivia and climbed a mountain. It was right up on top of this mountain, apparently. So we went up there. Well, long story short, someone had gotten there ahead of us, sawed it out of the rock strata, and it was gone. But not to be too disappointed, Kathy climbed around the edges of the mountain, climbed over the top of it, and finally found two more footprints that no one knew existed. So she was able to locate two more human footprints that are in excess of 2 million years old. It's a mountain about, 15,000 feet high now.
Footprints that are millions of years old?
Yeah, human footprints. It was really quite a thing. We thought that we'd made history, but the world largely ignored the discovery.
What are the implications of that? I mean, do people know exactly how long humans have been around and where and when, settlement, that kind of thing? I mean, does this fly in the face of something?
Oh, yeah, it flies in the face of conventional archaeology because most everyone you talk to, unless it's Michael Cremo or some of the fringe archaeologists, they will say, well, humans have been around for maybe 100, 150,000 years. And they cite all kinds of references that will support what they have to say. But there are those who believe that that's an improper figure. And there's, of course, emerging evidence that it's much older than that. So to find a footprint that is in excess of 2 million years old is contradictory to what science will accommodate, and probably why it was largely ignored.
Well, because it's unbelievable.
Well, there were some footprints found in England that were on a shoreline there. The water had eroded the shoreline enough to where these many, dozens of footprints, human footprints, had been found, and they were, I've forgotten now how old they were, but they were maybe a couple hundred thousand years old, as I recall. And I got a hold of the lead archaeologist and asked him, because he was making the claim, these are the oldest footprints of humans that have ever been found on Earth. So I got a hold of him, and I said, well, what about that one in Bolivia? No, that isn't real. Well, I didn't even bother telling him that we found two more. So, regular science isn't going to accommodate this.
Well, does that mean that there's something wrong with science in general? Because they don't follow the scientific method anymore, which is you look at the evidence, you evaluate it, come up with a hypothesis, try to disprove it, and then accept the results. Without fear or favor.
Well, that's how it's supposed to work. But
I've always been curious as to when this corruption of the scientific method actually began, or has it always been there kind of thing?
I don't know when it started, but it certainly is, certainly does have a tight grip on things now. And we really don't know why. I mean, there are things like the bones of giants that were found in northern Arizona through Utah into New Mexico and other places. I mean, there's not just this particular region in the States. But these giants had double row sets of teeth, had long red hair. They were, I don't know, 3 meters tall or taller. Doesn't exist. And if you were to find one, funny enough, you would go to jail and be fined $25,000 for having disturbed it. So we had to call off our search for that. But, you know, there are certain dynamics in the world of archaeology that are supposed to remain constant and uninterrupted. And I don't know why. It really, really boggles my mind because it isn't in line with scientific inquiry at all. It's basically more like a religion than anything else.
Well, I found government indoctrination works exactly the same way. If you can prevent the people from having an attachment to their history and their culture and their ancestors, you can control them because you get to make up whatever you want in order to fill in those gaps. And naturally, the gap gets filled with, by the way, you should be subservient to us.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And I don't think it's something as particular to your area or ours. It's more of a worldwide thing now. You know, we were just recently in Greece. And in Greece, there was this this grain called zea that, you know, it was used by the Spartans, the Grecians in these ancient times. And, you know, you've seen probably Spartacus or the 300 or any of these. And these people were fantastic warriors. Well, part of their diet was eating zea. The nice thing about zea is that it doesn't have any gluten in it, and they figured that gluten, you know, the regular wheat was for animals, it wasn't for people, and gluten clouds the mind. They themselves say that regular wheat causes your mind to become fuzzy, can't think straight. Well, and here they are now, it's illegal to grow zea in Greece. So go figure.
How interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very strange. Even the grains that they were eating, what's that, Cap? Well, you control the food, you control the people. And we see evidence of that even now in our own cultures, yours and ours as well. And over in Europe, too.
Thank you, Monsatan.
Yeah, Monsatan is right.
I have a big banner that says Moron Santo. Because if you're supporting those guys, you're a fucking moron.
Yeah,
I
know.
I can't even get over it. Hey, and in fact, another interesting theory I came across, in fact, I made up, was about smoking. You know, how there's like this big agenda to stop people from smoking and all over the place. Oh, it's bad for your health, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Native Americans called it the thinking herb. And I just came up with a conspiracy theory. Ah, this might be why they're trying to curb smoking cigarettes, because when you go out to have a ciggy, you've got some time to think about stuff, and they don't really want people to be thinking about stuff in this new age. But
no, well, you know. And you're absolutely right. The use of tobacco is historic, and it goes back a very long way. The same thing with marijuana. You know, what we call marijuana is actually cannabis. It was used for thousands of years. It was used as a medicine for thousands of years. But if you try to use it now in most countries, you know, and I've run into people with different disabilities, different diseases, cancer, for example. You know, the people with skin cancer is another example. Cannabis can help that. But regardless of what it might be able to do, if it's not part of the regular drug kingdom, the drug regime, then it's illegal, illicit, and you're not supposed to do it because, well, we told you you can't. And to me, that's like having a bully big brother, actually big brother, stepbrother, who slaps you around all the time and you can't get away from because you live in the same house with them. Not that I ever did, but that's just how I see it.
Well, it seems to me kind of like a bad and lazy parent, you know? They can't even bother explaining anything to their kids because they're just basically full of crap and they're just making it up as they go along because they don't know how to parent a child properly, you know, to help them. Right. And instead, it just kind of becomes about, you know, dominating them a little bit, not really explaining things fully, just so that, you know, they can continue on their normal adult life without the advent of children who are irritating to them. Why do I have to do that, Mummy?
Because I said so.
That's enough reason, isn't it?
Yeah. I always think of that, like, that's what the state does. That's what every establishment and anything with a hierarchical control structure does predominantly in order to keep people in line. Basically, you eliminate the need for explanation by having authority. And then if you've got authority, you don't have any need for justification of what you do. So you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Hey, you nailed it. That's exactly right.
The hell is the point in that? Where's humanity going?
Well, down the toilet, I'd say.
Yeah, flushed like the turd city it is. I do believe that this is something worthy of note and discussion because I was just thinking about I was out on the deck yesterday, just standing in the sun, and I was considering how my show kind of works, how I'm like making jokes and covering all these different eclectic topics and things like that. And I don't follow any mainstream media. I don't listen to mainstream radio. I don't read the newspaper. I'm not following blogs and articles and things of that nature. I'm kind of like a leaf on the wind, informationally speaking. But my philosophy is if I haven't heard it before, then it's news to me.
Yeah. Well, then that's us too. We don't watch the news. We don't listen to other radio, really. I mean, we listen to you once in a while because we really like your show. Dave Hodges is another good one we listen to. But a lot of folks are going, did you listen to Coast to Coast or did you listen to this or that? No, I didn't. I don't really have time. I'm busy. The ones I listen to are really specific and because I really enjoy them. But I guess by and large, in that respect, we are somewhat uninformed by the programming medias, maybe we're better off for it, I would hope.
Well, I think it was either Thomas Jefferson or Mark Twain that said this. It says, those who read nothing at all are uninformed. Those who read nothing but newspapers are misinformed.
That's good. I'll have to remember that.
Well, when it comes down to it, understanding the world around us is not an easy thing, and anybody who thinks that they've got it all figured out, like, I know everything, is somebody who obviously knows nothing. and the rest of the people are like, well, I don't know what's going on. They apparently know enough.
Yeah, well, and that's the truth. And sometimes, you know, too much information is just that, too much. I think a lot of times when you watch things like CNN and Fox and MSNBC and all these, you hear all these different viewpoints. But what I've noticed by and large is that they end up having a few people on there, usually with dissenting opinions, differing opinions, and it just becomes a shouting match. And I think this is kind of a reflection on what the mentality of the world has become. Most everything that I see seems to be geared towards the lowest common denominator of the cultural inhabitants of this world, whether it's in your country, our country, or wherever. It is taking the lowest common denominator and exploiting that as though that is what everyone is, and this is how everyone acts. And, of course, those people in that category will take a look and think, well, it's okay that I act like that now. Whether it's TV commercials or the news or TV shows, all this stuff is just becoming very strange to me.
Well, it's like follow the leader, and a lot of my friends are round about roughly twice my age or more, and they always use these phrases like back in my day or back in the day or in those days and such because they've lived a number of decades longer than I and they've experienced a lot more changes than I have in my short lifespan currently. And it seems to me that what has happened is we've all become out of touch with our history unless you've really lived through it. And so you kind of have to keep reminding people that this is not the way it always was. People weren't always this dumb. People weren't always this easy to manipulate. The Department of War wasn't always called the Department of Defense. Bacon and eggs wasn't always seen as a good breakfast. You know, that kind of thing. And people are unable or unwilling, at least, to understand that there is a difference throughout the time that we spend here between how people have been in the past and how they are now. And nobody who I've spoken to who's older than me, who's experienced things, has told me that people have gotten any brighter, or that people have gotten any more caring, or that people have become any more radically informed, even since the internet.
No, I agree with you completely, and that's absolutely a correct statement. If anything, people have become more isolated and less caring and more opinionated about things that they don't know a damn thing about except what they heard on the news. They don't have an opinion of their own.
I made a joke the other day. It says, if you won't be a listener of mine for long if you take yourself too seriously, because I'm sooner or later going to make a joke about it and you'll hate me for it.
Well, yeah, that's someone that's short-sighted, I'm sure.
Well, and again, we were talking about appealing to the lowest common denominator, and I think that's really the difference with this show. Is I'm not trying to get the masses behind me and things of that nature, namely because I don't believe the masses have ever really changed anything. The masses get changed by small minorities, not the other way around.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, take a look at what Gandhi did. He one person and changed the way people think just because of what he did and how he acted.
There's an old phrase, never underestimate the ability of a small determined minority to change the world. In truth, it's the only thing that ever has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly correct. You know, you nailed it. And I think that's what it's going to take now. I have a feeling that there will be a time when people are going to take a step back collectively. And they're going to see why some of these folks are happier or doing the things they're doing. And they're going to ask why. And the answer they're going to come up with is because they were thinking freely. They weren't influenced by external forces or fooled by the media.
And, of course, this means that we have a responsibility to replace the media in and of itself, because they're no longer relevant.
No, you're right. I mean, a lot of folks I've talked to, of course, they're in the same mindset as we are, but they all feel that it no longer is talking to them in a way to where information is really going to be provided in a form that you can give it some serious thought. The media is basically telling you what to think and when to think it. And that's totally wrong, because if the media is controlled, then it's nothing more than a propaganda machine. And that's what I think, and a lot of folks are thinking, has happened. I have a friend, not naming names or circumstances, so just take it as, you know, for what it's worth. But I've been told by him that there are no stories that go on the news unless it's approved from higher up. And higher up means people that are in charge of making sure that only the news that they want out there is broadcast on public domains and public TV. Part of the issue is, if they wanted to sell you a new truck, how many people are going to feel like buying a damn new truck or car after they see some story that is destructive, disturbing, or disabling? Nobody. So they have the commercials planned out in relation to what the storyline is in the news. That's how it works. If you watch the news, you'll see. The news is going to be propagated in such a way that it supports the commercials or the attitude you have before the commercial comes on.
Yeah, like if it bleeds, it leads. Like, let's say the top story is somebody who gets hit by a pickup truck or something like that and gets dragged 100 meters and then finally gets crushed to death. And then cut to commercial. Buy the new Dodge pickup truck. It's going to be fantastic.
Oh, you didn't get one. It's a drag, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for, not to drag it out any further than it needs to. Jerry and Kathy Wells, can you please quote us your website so people can go and find out more about you?
Yeah, absolutely. There are two to pay attention to. One is Expeditions TV, spelled with an X, XPEDITIONS.TV. The other is our new network, Channel U. It's channel-u.com. And that's where you'll find me on Friday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be back right after the break. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can go there and check out all the free archives, and if you like the fact that there's somebody out there who gives people a voice, well, I don't really give people a voice, I just kind of amplify whatever the heck they're saying, really, with a radio show. That's kind of what you've got a moral obligation to do, in my opinion. So if you like that fact, then please visit the website and make a donation, or preferably start up a regular donation of about $5 a month today. And joining me now is Eric Hollaback. Hollaback, brother, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up, Vinny? Yeah, this is simulcast, homie. It's also going to be on the Highway Diary podcast, so check that out, you know.
The Highway Diary. It sounds like a novel about heroin.
Very, very similar to that. A lot of drug talk going on, you know, expanding consciousness, seeing the new world order from the spirit world and shit, you know?
Well, give us a little bit of a breakdown about who you are and what you do then for the listeners who are unaware.
For sure, yeah. I'm a comic, and I live in New Orleans. I go to grad school at the University of New Orleans. I'm studying screenwriting. I was working in Los Angeles for 5 years doing reality shows and stuff like that. And then I got a bit disillusioned when I started realizing that, you know, everybody who was at a higher level of pay grade in reality shows were Freemasons, you know? And there would be like a structure of, like, you know, people making $100 a day were the normal profane peasants. And then everybody making $5,000 a week were Freemasons. And, you know, I tried to get in that racket a little bit more, and it kind of dried up. And I just decided to, you know, focus on writing some screenplays. And but yeah, I'm just fascinated by the cult of Freemasonry and New World Order, but I'm not a joiner. I just don't know, you know. Even though it would probably advance my life from everything I know about it.
Well,
you know,
what they say, there's nothing free about Freemasonry.
Yeah. But it's just, you never know what you're going to have to pay for on the other side.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of something that everybody has holding over them. Ooh, I wonder what's going to happen to me on Judgment Day. Was standing on a black and white tiled floor, pledging allegiance to Satan and sucking the Grand Master's thumb. Thumb's a euphemism for something. Gonna get me into the pearly gates? Or, is it something a little bit weirder?
Yeah. You never know, and it's just like, it just, or you're going to have some alien shoot his proboscis into your eye. You know, you never know what's up.
You know, the word proboscis really gets me going. I don't know why. Would you be able to enlighten us as to what actually got you interested in all of this? I mean, were your parents into it, or was it kind of like a work experience? Then you go, whoa, hold on. Was it that just finding out that the Freemasons get paid more than everybody else?
No, I think it started back in undergrad when I, it's really like 9/11. I think that, you know, my dad was working on Wall Street at the time. He was very close. We couldn't contact him. You know, everyone took us in school, and they brought us in a library, and we watched these towers crumble down. And, you know, actually it was very weird because I had like a weird psychic experience. I've never really talked about this before, but me and someone called Justin Fogarty, just some kid in high school, 2 days before 9/11, we looked at each other and we were dead serious, and we said, I think something very, very wrong is about to happen. we just could feel something very like visceral, this boiling energy in the ether. Then it happened, and you know, for 3 years I totally believed the official version. And then I think it was, you know, some friends were telling me it was an inside job. I didn't believe them. And it wasn't until I saw like a 2.5 hour lecture by Stephen Jones that kind of blew the doors open on what was really going on. And he talked about the thermite in the dust. And he said, I don't know who did this, but this is what fucking science means. And you know what I'm saying? So that kind of started me on this just endless rabbit hole where I'm just insatiable for all this new information, you know?
See, I think the rabbit hole kind of, I'm not sure if it's ended for me per se, but there's two aspects for a rabbit hole. How deep is it and how wide is it? How wide it is however, whatever's going to be able to fit through, you know? Can I insert myself in here? No, I'm too fat, bro. And I think discovering the walls of the rabbit hole was something that was really important to me, like knowing how far you can actually spread your wings and kind of think out, because it's kind of like a rabbit hole spider web, right? There's holes going down in all different freaking directions, and it's so crazy, so confusing, that you have to kind of like start plugging a few of them up on occasion and just say, not worth investigating yet. No. Oh, that one's very interesting. I'll add that to the list. Oh, that screwed up my life. Fantastic. I've learned something for a change.
Yeah, there is something weird about Scientology. You know, as you go up the levels in that cult of Scientology, you know, you're OT level one, OT level two. I have a friend who's 28 years old, and she's been a Scientologist her whole life. She hasn't even gone clear yet. And the reason for that is because, you know, it costs $10,000. But anyway, they say that if you learn levels above what level you're at, like if you're an OT level 2 Scientologist and you hear the doctrine of OT level 3, your mind will explode. And it's I feel like that sometimes going down. It's like your paradigm.
So do they have any video evidence, you know, just like that scene on Scanners or whatever it was, or the dude's head explodes and a rather fantastic oh, he gave me sacred knowledge!
Your head actually doesn't explode. The actual doctrine that's written down by L. Ron Hubbard and is thus true is that you'll get pneumonia and die. That's actually what they actually believe. But, you know, I think about that. And that's why the South Park is so dangerous for them, because what South Park revealed was the doctrine of OT level 3, which is all the alien shit, you know? And you have to be a Scientologist and spend so much money to go up the bridge to that level to find that information. And all of a sudden, a lot of OT3 and OT4 Scientologists left after that happened because they said...
I guess they thought that it was OTT.
Well, yeah, you know me. But they were like, why didn't everyone get to pneumonia and die? And they were very confused about that.
Maybe,
you know?
Maybe they didn't get pneumonia. Maybe they got the old pneumonia. Or maybe they needed to clean the floors and they needed some ammonia.
Well, yeah.
Maybe they got divorced from the scientific church and had to pay alimony. I'm taking this way too far. I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just like, you know, I was very impressed with your interview with Donald Marshall, you know. And it's like, you know, what I think about conspiracies is a lot of times, you know, there's like an overlap. It's like a Venn diagram. You know, you'll hear what Bill Cooper says, and that'll have something to do with what Savali says. That'll have something to do with what Al Bielek says. That'll have something to do with George Green. And they all kind of overlap in this weird way. But then there are these other fringes of new information that they bring to you. And to, like, put the whole tapestry together. And there's also such a thing as crazy people. You know, schizophrenia is a real disease, and people are fucking out their gourd, you know? And so it's very difficult to put it together. It's almost like the quest for knowledge is more noble than any kind of truth, because, you know, having the whole tapestry would take forever, you know?
Yeah, I think people are just kind of like, they figure out a point in their life where they're comfortable with what they think that they know and then learn no more. Because if you do learn more, it'll mess up your life. And I kind of came to terms with that, and I was like, okay, basically what I have to come to terms with is, in order to learn new things all the time, I have to constantly have my life messed up, basically, and have to rearrange things in a more or less constant manner. Like a Rubik's Cube that keeps moving a move backwards or something like that when you're not looking. So you can't ever solve it.
Have you seen any of the Andrew Bishalgo stuff about time travel?
I've interviewed him like 8 times, bro.
Really? I'm trying to get him in touch with him. I can't get in touch with him. He's one of my favorite guys. So he's like a lawyer. Like, that's what he does for a living, and all he's talking about is aliens and time travel. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing about the deep underground classified projects, and he's talked about with Bernie Mendez about this, is that they're not 100% sure how to quantify a lot of the experiences that they think that they remember, because of the nature of the Pegasus program, with the amount of different tech that was going into chronovisors and compartmentalization. They don't know whether what they were seeing was actually real or a simulation a lot of the time. And it's only been since they've met each other after Andrew went public about Project Pegasus that they've been able to kind of talk shop with each other and actually try and corroborate things.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, MK Ultra is a real thing. You know, all of the people that worked on these super classified government projects had to go through levels of mind control where afterward they can program each of the people. Like, it's so classified that they wanted to, like, if the Russians, like, grabbed somebody, they could, you know, have their mind erased and not really understand what had happened. And then they would need to be deprogrammed by someone very specific or whatever. So it is weird how, you know, the people that survive these projects actually, you know, don't know what's real or what's not, because they've been intensely, and, you know, there's been Senate hearings about MKUltra and people talking about being tortured and having their minds split into two hemispheres. And so they could protect themselves, you know, and I don't know. A lot of my podcasts are just I interview comedians about going to open mics and stuff and grinding their way as a comic. So maybe the stuff I'm talking about on this episode is a little. Anyway, I shouldn't talk about it.
Mm. But I always thought it would be funny if South Park did a episode about MK Ultra and had that the counselor dude who always says MK. You know, to be the protagonist in that particular episode. I think it'd be freaking funny. Mind control is bad. I'm gay ultra.
I'm not sure how down with conspiracies they are. You know, they did a 9/11 episode, and I think they came on the wrong side of it, you know, so.
Well, you know, not everybody can be an expert on everything.
It's just there's some things that are so obvious. Do you find yourself, Vinny, like, alienated?
I don't know about you, bro. But I don't think anything's obvious. If anything, the more obvious it seems, the less obvious it actually is in reality. It's kind of like the fractal universe theory. As soon as you start looking into one thing, it starts splitting out and going into all these different patterns that start to repeat themselves, and then you look into those, and then they start to repeat themselves and split off into a pattern again. It's almost like there's a layer on top of everything, and it's all onionated, you know? There's a bazillion layers to absolutely everything. Like, I'm not even sure about anything anymore, Eric. Like, really? Really? I don't know exactly what the meaning of Illuminati all-seeing eye symbolism is. You know? I'm not 100% sure exactly what all the ingredients in the vaccines that are being pumped into kids like 50 times before they're born are. I don't know the exact intentions behind the people. So it's kind of like having a, I don't know. How would an asteroid in an asteroid belt free associate with other ones without crashing into them? It's kind of a balancing act, isn't it?
It's a balancing act to keep your sanity when, you know, you watch the... Everyone talks about this, but it's so obvious, like, for me, Building 7, when you see Building 7 just crumple into its own footprint, and then more people, like, don't question it. I find myself alienated socially at a lot of parties, at a lot of, just in general... maybe I have a general social anxiety, but when you start with, like, our paradigm is so different than most people. Most people are happy to pursue a life of promotion so they can buy more shit that they're advertised to, and it's all brainwashing, and they don't really think about, like, you know, the brainwashing that goes into it. They just want, like, a better car or a better this, and they spend their lives in this kind of, like, in this merry-go-round of you know, commercialism, and they kind of buy into the system of wanting to be comfortable. And where we live on the day-to-day life, like, our paradigm is so different. Like, do you find that you're, like, you find yourself having trouble relating with normal people who are kind of, like, indoctrinated into the system?
Oh, nah, man. I love talking to slave scum.
You know what I mean, though?
No, well, not anymore. I mean, I used to, but I've kind of gotten over it. And the way I got around it is you kind of learn different discourse. So you sort of, it's like a color palette, you know, when you're trying to animate something on a computer or draw something with a paintbrush, you can mix certain colors together and there's only a certain amount of colors you can choose from. And when you're talking with slave scum, you kind of got to make sure that your palette is relatively limited. You only limit yourself to things that they're actually quite willing to accept. And they'll actually go, wow, that's really, really profound and awesome. But you take one step forward, you add one color that's not in their palette yet, and they kind of shoo you away. And it takes a lot of practice, more or less. And I find that the best way to get through with it in terms of exposing government propaganda or whatever, because A1, nobody likes the government. B2, everybody thinks the media is lying to them. And the only way you can actually get that across in terms of the reality without them getting angry with you is to make them laugh about it. And incidentally, that's the only way to deal with that reality in and of itself.
Yeah.
You got to prioritize hanging out with people that are different a lot of the time. Otherwise, you stagnate. And if you don't have good friends that you're doing creative endeavors with, it basically hastens your downward slope, and you become misanthropic, more or less. You just start to hate people in general. And I caught myself doing it one time. Like, we were just me and my wife driving along in the car, and I pointed out someone and said a whole bunch of nasty things about them. It was just like a total random person. And I knew nothing about them, and I assumed everything about them was bad based upon how I thought that they looked. And I thought, how freaking arrogant am I to assume what everybody knows everybody is and what everybody does based upon physical appearance alone? That's not how simple the world is, in my opinion.
Yeah, I get very angry when the elites call themselves the elite and not, like, the worst sociopaths ever. Like, what I get very frustrated about is the fact that, you know, why Newton said, like, you know, I only know what I know because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. And why don't the elites, as they like to call themselves, like, put in the textbooks real science instead of suppressing science? Like, they suppress the fact that, like, cars can run on water so that they can maintain an oil monopoly. But it's like, if they let the public stand on the shoulders of the real science of you can run a car on water, then exponentially, if you expose everybody to that, exponentially, you'll see our science increase, and you'll get the biodiversity of the masses and all of their brains and all of their problem-solving skills, you'll get the benefit of that. But instead, they like to only cherry-pick one or two people, put them in secret projects, brainwash them three times over, and then they start to say, tell those people where we are scientifically. And so, and also, it's like, if you look at capitalism, the only reason why capitalism works is the biodiversity of the people's brains, how they make new products and you know, how they advance things and make the best shit. Like, if you are elite, then you can make the best shit, and then you can, people will buy your shit, and then
that's kind of more along the lines of, if you're elite, you still have creativity and you're not a completely creationless stealing psychopathic scumbag who can't actually create their way out of a paper bag.
Exactly. And so they all they do is they're paranoid, they suppress, they assassinate any whistleblowers, they imprison people who have good ideas. And then,
a couple of friends of mine are like libertarians and they're still arguing this whole capitalism thing. And I'm like, bro, what you're doing is you're arguing a point that would be correct if there was no such thing as scumbaggery. All right. If criminal elements who had a lot of money, power, and influence didn't exist, then I'd agree with everything that you said. Privatizing all our assets would be great. Except now, if you try to apply capitalism or libertarian principles to our modern society, it's run by criminals. So if you're privatizing your assets statewide, you know, trying to get them more efficient or whatever, as the theory would go, what you're doing is you're selling them to private criminal interests who will extort money from everybody until the end of time, until such time as people actually hang the son of a bitch.
And I, for people that don't believe this exact insertion that you can run a car on water, I'd like to put out that there was a guy called Stan Meyer who invented the water car in America in like 1991. Then a company in 2004 was called Genpax, and that was a Japanese company that Reuters covered, Genpax. And then all of a sudden they go, oh, we mismanage our resources. We can't. And they said, we made a car that runs on water. And then they're like, we mismanage our resources. What the fuck does that even mean?
We run out of water.
We made a miracle. And somehow capitalism, nobody's interested in sustaining this. You know, yeah. You solved all the world's problems. And now there's a company out of Finland. I don't know if you see this. They made a 920 horsepower car that runs on salt water. And it's called the Equant or something, and it was in some auto show in Europe. Finland made it. It's called Equant or something like this. But
it sounds like an Engelbert Humperdinck song or something.
But you know, there are three companies that have tried to put out the water car, and so far, you know, hopefully the third one takes. But as soon as I saw the Stan Meyer video in college in undergrad, when I was 19, I go. What? Okay, I followed it very much, and then I saw his last words were, I've been poisoned, you know, and then it's like, well, I can't go back to sleep now, you know, and I can't go back to sleep, and I can't, you know, put gasoline in my car anymore without wanting to fucking murder somebody.
Yeah.
Because I know it's all bullshit. Well, I know I've been lying to my whole life.
I call it the needing to pee when you're in bed analogy. You know, you have to get out of bed to go take a leak. But it'll actually take a while because you don't want to get out of bed because bed's warm and it's cold outside and you don't want to get your willy out in that nice frigid air. But eventually you need to pee so badly that you don't have a choice. And what I hope to do as a radio show host is just try and convince people that they're not free, they're slaves, and they don't have a choice, any other choice but to resist and to support people who aren't following the current paradigm of enslavement and scumbaggery, whatever it might be. And it's incidentally that you've come up with the water fuel card thing because I got an email from a company not 2 days ago, I think, that have a picture of their water generator. So you pour water into the generator, start it up, and it starts going, bro. Another friend of mine just mentioned to me today, and he mentioned it to me yesterday, and he reiterated himself today that a friend of his is just starting up a water car company here in New Zealand. So I don't know about you, bro, but synchronicity has been really, really hotting up for me this last couple of weeks.
That's beautiful, you know, when you're do you think that you're like guided by any kind of angels or something? Do you think that you are opening up your chakras as you get closer?
I don't know. It's more like once you're aware of who you are and what you're here to do, you'll start to notice synchronous occurrences in your life, and if you pay attention to them, they change your journey on a rather consistent basis, and they don't seem to let you down. But if you ignore them, on the other hand, annoying things happen. Like I think it was a couple of years back, actually. I was like coming up home just from work, and something says to me, Vinny, take down the washing, it's going to rain. It's like fully clear blue sky, sun is shining or whatever, but still there's this voice in my head going, take down the washing, it's going to rain. And I was like, nah, I can't be bothered. And I walked upstairs. Not 5 minutes later, it starts pissing down and all my dry washing got moist. You know?
Yeah,
That kind of stuff happens to me all the time. I used to get irritated with it, but then I learned to stop ignoring whatever that thing inside my head is telling me. Those sort of impressions, those intuition moments. But anyway, Eric, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the broadcast segment with you today. Would you be able to rattle off your website for my listeners so they can go and check out more of your work?
Yeah, check out the Highway Diary podcast. I also got a comedy web series called Here Comes Godot. Go to herecomesgodot.com. I did it with all my college buddies. It's really funny, and we have a new episode coming out this Thanksgiving. So herecomesgodot.com. Check that out.
All right, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of The Vinnie Eastwood Show. Now joining me from America is Falcon. Welcome to the show, bro.
Thank you for having me, Vinnie.
I'd love it if you'd explain both to myself and the listeners just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do, because I'm familiar with a little bit of your knowledge when it comes to you know, what you discuss and whatnot in terms of economics, veganism, and from the Christopher Green show and some Facebook comments. But other than that, I don't know a terribly large amount about you, bro.
Well, I am an author. I've written two books. My name is actually Don Pontius, and I've written two books on disaster and or, let's say, the end of the world as we know it preparedness. And I host a weekly radio show on three different radio streams, RAS Radio, Revere Radio Network, and Liberty Movement Radio, involving my my subject matter being disaster prepared. And the show's name is In Case of Emergency. So, you know, your listeners could find that by doing a little search on Facebook. And I also work in the oil and gas industry. That's how I make my living. I work in the oil and gas industry here in the United States.
Well, that's kind of ironic. And it's good that you know a lot about disaster preparedness, because now you're on the Vinnie Eastwood show and you must be ready for it.
Yeah, well, I'm ready for a train wreck. No, I'm kidding. No, actually, I have a wide variety of interests. I mean, as you noted, I got involved in alternative media years ago with Christopher Green. And the main thrust of his show, as you remember, was the economic downfall the United States and how politics was playing havoc, not only in the United States, but in Europe. And I'm seeing it in your country, too, in New Zealand. In fact, the first time I ever heard the term scumbaggery was out of your mouth while you were on Christopher Green's show all those many years ago. And it stuck with me. So every time I hear or I see you type scumbaggery on like Facebook, I hear it in your voice.
I once saw a picture of Morgan Freeman on Facebook, and it's a meme, and it says, "You are now reading this in my voice."
Well, that's pretty accurate. I mean, if I put like a special word or phrase to someone's voice, I will always read it in that voice, and it's just the way I've always been. But it's kind of funny because I read it and they get this Kiwi accent, scumbaggery, and I'm like, it's Vinny, you know.
Oh yeah, that's me, man. Hey, and one of the things I kind of wanted to talk to you about, I had this this big thread on my Facebook page about veganism. Yeah. And it was the reason why I created a South Park meme. Dude, I'm staying out of this one.
Well, to me, it's I'm not against anybody eating the way they want to eat. I just really advocate eating healthfully in a manner that is prescribed by your body's design. I mean, if you believe in evolution and natural selection, or if you believe in a creator, it doesn't matter. You have to look at the fundamental basic design and function of the human body and its purpose. The intestinal tract of the human body just is not designed for a pure vegetable diet. In fact, many vegetables, beans, legumes, all grains, you're talking about the seeds of these plants, and they load them, the plants themselves load them with these chemicals that are anti-nutrients. They actually leach nutrients out of your body. And there are
I thought of a great meme about this, like Monsanto and legumes and something, like what was it? The creature from the black legume.
That's awesome. I would put that. I would make one of those. That's a pretty good one. And what led me to this is actually I was suffering from a lot of health problems. I was eating what I thought was healthy. I was eating very close to organic, as close as I could afford. You know, organic food is very expensive here in the States. I was eating natural. I was eating unprocessed foods, but I was still consuming grains. I was still consuming a lot of beans and rice, even though they were more natural. My health didn't improve. My weight didn't improve. And then I happened across something called, at the time, it was called the Paleo diet. Now it's called a Primal diet. It's had a couple of different face changes, but it's nothing like the Atkins diet. It's nothing like these pure protein diets. It really advocates eating the way that your body is designed to assimilate nutrients, and that is 80% lean, grass-fed or natural meats, as close to natural as you can get them, and the other 20% in any food that does not require being cooked to be consumed. Because the understanding is, if you have to cook a food to consume it, because eating it raw is either poisonous, like in the case of potatoes, or in some cases some legumes, then your body is not designed to assimilate it, and cooking is the only way to break down or destroy the poisons that are naturally occurring in these plants in order for you to assimilate them even partially. So that led me to a lot of research, and it turns out that these guys aren't very far from the truth, and in fact, a vast majority of vegans, especially in Europe, are suffering from extreme malnourishment and are forced to take multivitamins, a vast array of multivitamins, just to make up for the nutrients that they not only lose through their now quote-unquote naturally chosen diet, which is veganism, but also because they choose not to consume meat for whatever reason. And if you have a moral reason or an ethical reason not to consume meat, great. I'm proud that you are willing to stand up for your ethics and your morals, but you're killing yourself to do so. It's simply put, no vegetable in the world cannot create vitamin B12. It has to be created chemically, or it has to be created in the muscle proteins of an animal. And that's the only way you can get this particular vitamin, unless you take it, you know, as in a supplemental form, which is a chemical. And I don't want to put chemicals in my body.
It's not exactly the wisest move, is it? And I think the the main argument that I had was I completely agree with the tenets of it. You know, we're killing animals. Mm-hmm. It's immoral. Mm-hmm. It's unethical. It's murderous. And we're doing the factory farming and all of that kind of stuff. What I don't agree with is being guilt-tripped and being accused of being some kind of unethical murdering scumbag because I have a burger every now and again.
Well, and again, I want to make sure that the vegans out there that are listening and right now they're writhing in their own agony because they want to get back at me for this, and they are more than welcome to try. I want to point out that I do not advocate factory farming at all. I do not appreciate what they're doing to those animals. Morally, ethically, it's reprehensible. It is a money-making scheme, and they're hurting not only the environment in doing so, but they're hurting the people who are consuming the meat. I advocate small family-run farms with naturally raised animals that are humanely handled, humanely culled from the herd, or if you will, harvested, and it's natural for a human being to be morally and ethically upset by what they see in movies like Food Incorporated, because frankly they've taken something that is natural, which is like eating a meat, for example, and they've turned it into a money making scheme like Monsanto has done with farming. It's ridiculous.
I've got very little patience for those kind of big agri-corporate businesses and things of that nature. And it seems to me that there's I'm not sure if Agenda 21 is involved entirely here, but Monsanto definitely wants to control the world's food supply. They definitely are accumulating many, many family farms as we speak. Like, even right now, there's goodness knows how many thousands of family farms across the United States that are being basically requisitioned by Monsanto because their fields got infected by these dangerous GMO crops and whatnot. And it seems there's sort of a cult-like element to the vegan quote-unquote movement, and
there is.
That's the only thing that I disagree with. Is if you're going to join something for the right reasons, join it for the right reasons. If you're going to join something because you can't think for yourself and you go about it with a cult-like veneration, then that's not healthy. Doesn't matter what your diet is.
No, and militancy in veganism is also unhealthy because then you're walking away from what you consider your moral standpoint. You're morally against violence on animals, yet you'll perpetrate violence on your fellow human beings, their properties, etc. Like in England, for example, there's such a large movement of militant vegans that butcher shops are frequently vandalized. Windows are broken. People's places of business are burned to the ground. It's flying in the face of logic when you take your cult-like dedication to a diet and turn it into a violent, aggressive principle because you don't agree with people who eat differently than you. That it flies in the face of logic. If you're telling me don't kill animals because it's morally wrong and it's ethically wrong, yet you'll turn that very violence against your fellow man. That it makes no sense to me, Vinny. It really doesn't.
Well, maybe you just need to put on your psychopath goggles for a bit, you know. That's what I've been saying for a while, you know. If something doesn't make sense, just imagine for a moment that you're a crazed, psychopathic scumbag with more money than God, and then see if it makes sense. Oh, wait! It does!
Right, and I also want to point out that, you know, the a lot of the Western vegans point to the Asians and say they eat a mostly vegetable diet and they consume quite a bit of rice and they're very healthy and they live for a long, long time. What they're not pointing out, though, is these people have, over the centuries that they've lived in these areas, adapted to eating these types of food. They have made an adaptation over thousands of years, not a couple of hundred years. I mean, let's face it, the modern veganistic movement in Western United States, in the Western world, came about really heavily in the 60s, which is probably what we'd say 40, 50 years ago. It really came into heavy swing with the hippie movement and the back to earth movement. And I have a moral thing about killing animals. That's not long enough for your diet to change, adapt normally. And you're forcing this new diet upon yourself and you're doing harm to your body.
Not to mention, I mean, I've eaten a lot of Vietnamese food and Chinese food and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's copious quantities of meat throughout the diet, so I don't know what they're talking about.
Right. Well, what they're talking about is the poor in India and the poor in Asia who consume mostly vegetables, legumes, and rices for either practical economic purposes because they're so poor they can afford nothing else, or because they have religious beliefs that prohibit them from consuming animal flesh like the Hindus. And I want to point out, Vinny, that people don't understand how important vitamin B12 is to the body, and it comes only from meat or chemical sources because there's not enough B12 in soy or soy products in a usable type for the human body to fulfill the need of the human body for B12. And the first manifestation of B12 deficiency is typically mental disturbances. And these things can range from mood swings, abnormal mood swings, mental slowness, memory problems, and all the way through to hallucinations, depression, and severe psychosis. And they can get physical symptoms as well. You know, so this is not a joke. I mean, just talking about one vitamin that is in the proper proportions and at the proper type that can be assimilated by the human body, it's found only in meat or meat protein, and yet vegans argue that eating meat is not natural. Well, I mean, I have hundreds of thousands of years, if you believe in evolution and old Earth, in fact, quite a few millennia of evidence to the contrary. Our forefathers didn't make spears and bows and arrows to fight with each other. They made it to gather food in the form of animal flesh. They were opportunistic omnivores. We are still opportunistic omnivores. In fact, you could eat for a while a pure vegan diet and be fine. It's the long-term effects that get to you. You need to consume some type of protein from an animal source in order to get the proper nutrition your body needs.
And I think this, there's another element here as well, is about herbivore animals that get so much protein from eating grass. I mean, you look at the muscle on, say, the average horse or the average cow. I mean, these are creatures that have evolved to extract the necessary vitamins and minerals and proteins from that particular plant matter so that they don't need to eat meat at all. However, we haven't had several hundred thousand years to evolve that kind of a digestion system. We don't have three stomachs and we don't chew the cud either.
Well, you can also point out that a gorilla, one of man's closest relatives genetically speaking, they are herbivores, but they have a massive digestive system. Their gut is four times the size of a human gut. That is because they consume heavy plant walls in the form of like bamboo and leaves, etc., and they need much larger digestive systems to process all of that plant material in order to extract any kind of usable nutrition from it. And in fact, there is not a single enzyme in the human digestive system that will break down vegetable cellulose to the point where you can extract any kind of nutrition from it. That's where cooking comes in.
Are you sure about that? I mean, because we've seen, for example, my former producer helped to make a documentary film called Real and Raw. Do you know much about the raw food diet? Because I've seen some amazing, amazing positive effects from that. People cured of their diabetes and various other diseases that just kind of disappear after eating raw for just 30 days.
Okay, well, let me explain about raw, though. When you cut raw, when you go into a raw food or a living fooder or a sprouteritarian type diet, you're literally cutting out all the things that are bad for you, the processed foods. You're cutting out the processed flour. You're cutting the processed sugars. You're cutting out all the things that have had massive amounts of studies that show cause more disease in the human body than anything else. While you're on a raw food diet, you will improve health-wise. You will extract some nutrition. I'm not saying you'll starve to death nutritionally, but it's going to be so insufficient that long term you will have to take excessive amounts of vitamin supplementation in order to make up for what you're not getting from your food. Now, some raw fooders even go as far to eat raw meat or very, very, very lightly cooked meat. And that is that's kind of a form of paleo. If you really want to get down to the nitty gritty, they even eat some dairy, and those are like more or less a form of raw lacto vegetarian, but they have to eat like raw dairy. They believe that nothing should be processed at all. But still, you're still talking about short term. 30 days is not long term. I'm talking about 30 years, 3 years. I'm talking about 12 months. You go and you talk to anybody who has been a vegan for multiple years, and you will find out for sure that they have a cabinet full of vitamins and mineral supplements that they take because they need these things in order to function properly. Otherwise, they start getting things like beriberi.
I don't know what that is, but I have a joke on this thing. You know why cows can't wear flip-flops?
Why is that?
Because they lack toes.
Oh, my God. That's bad. That is horribly bad.
There's an old saying, if you have to say it wasn't that bad, then it probably was that bad.
Oh, God, that was terrible, man. But again, I also would like to point out, too, that fats that you get from processed oils are not the same as fats that you get from animal sources. And if you really know anything about physiology, you understand that the human brain is approximately 80% fat. And you need these complex long-chain fatty acids in order for your brain to function properly and your nervous system to function properly, because these complicated long-chain fatty acid molecules are extracted from the fats in the animal proteins and whatnot, and they're fed to your body to help reinforce the brain, the nervous system, your blood vessel walls. Every part of your body requires these long chain fatty acids, and you can't get them anywhere but meat.
Now, I also wanted to relay this. The mm-hmm. veganism thing is very similar to the feminism thing.
And there's
the reason why I say this is because I know a mm-hmm. lot of women who are really strong and are really awesome, mm-hmm. and they kind of mm-hmm. consider themselves feminists, but they don't hate men, and they're not overly aggressive, and they actually appear very feminine. Whereas mm-hmm. there's another element of the feminist movement who are highly militant, hate everything mm-hmm. that there is about men, and are incredibly aggressive, and they act more like men than most men do today. And it seems to sort of like an ironic counterspin to the original inception of the movement, which was hijacked by communist scumbags who were well-financed.
Well, and I wanted to point out, too, that if anyone out there has the drive and the will to be a militant anything, whether it's a feminist or a vegan or a carnivore, why are you focusing all of that will, that strength, that presence of mind and spirit on a diet or a fact that you are a certain gender? Why not focus that incredible powerful will against the people who are truly hurting you, your governments, the people who are truly taking away the things that make your life worthwhile, the big banks? Focus that energy, that colossal energy that you have focusing on your diet or your gender, and pay attention to the banks, pay attention to the government, rather than attacking your fellow human beings. I mean, truly, there's only one outcome for all of us. We're all human beings. That's all that matters. We're all going to die. That, at the end of the day, is across the board. I mean, 10 out of 10 people die on a long enough timeline. But why not make life here much more livable, much more pleasant? Let's take that energy rather than trying to infight amongst each other. I'm a vegan. I'm a carnivore. I'm a fruitarian, whatever. I'm a feminist. Feminists, men are not your enemy. Your enemy is your government. Your enemy is a bank. They're robbing you. They're robbing you crazy. Just look at what they're doing. They're taking away your rights. They're taking away your money. So just go ahead and refocus that energy. That's all I'm saying that we should do.
I think it's sort of like applying unequal blame to where it's kind of not deserved. So let's say, for mm-hmm. example, you're a vegan, and instead of blaming the massive mega agribusiness and giving them crap and writing them letters and sabotaging their operations and things like that, they don't do anything like that. They go to local mm-hmm. businesses, small people who can't defend themselves against attacks and things like that. It's almost like they become some sort of vicious gang who attacks people who actually have very little or nothing to do with the things that they're inherently saying that they're fighting against. Is this a symptom of B12 brain deficiency or something like that?
No, what I really think it is it's a subversion into the various subcultures that are found in Western societies. I mean, we are literally being redirected to fight against one another rather than the government. It wouldn't surprise me in the least bit if these movements aren't funded and pushed and infiltrated by people who are trying to drag your eyes away from the magician on the stage. You know, don't pay attention to what the right hand is doing. Pay attention to what these other people are doing. So literally, they're being redirected. A house divided will fall on itself. And they're true. I'm a true believer that there's a grand conspiracy out there between the banks and the governments to keep us as stupid and ignorant as possible to what they're trying to perpetrate all around the world. And in doing so, they're encouraging infighting between vegans and people who eat meat, between feminists and non-feminists, between homosexuals and heterosexuals. There needn't be all of these arguments and these fights. I mean, we are all human beings. We all have basic rights, and they're being stolen from us. Left, right, and center, and we are letting it happen because we're more concerned with whether or not you eat vegetables as a primary source of nutrition or you eat meat and vegetables. That's what we're paying attention to instead, and it's frustrating.
Well, there's a it's kind of like save the planet, kill yourself. That's what all of these movements say to me. If I really just look at them right for a second and break it down, okay, save the planet, kill yourself. That's their entire mentality, and they don't have any respect for human life, and yet they're supposed to be protecting animal life, and that just doesn't make any sense to me. Falcon, thank you very much for your contributions to the show today. Do you have a website something you'd like to plug?
Actually, I do. If they want, if listeners are interested, I have, again, my Sunday show. It's called In Case of Emergency. They can find that on Facebook. Just search in the top bar, In Case of Emergency. They'll pop it up, and I post my show times and my topics. And also, I mentioned the radio stations that I stream on. It happens on Sundays between 5 Eastern Standard Time and 7 Eastern Standard Time right now. And from there, they can link off to my other page, which is about my book, and find my webpage and my blog, etc.
All right. Thank you very much. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in. And bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, and it's coming up to Christmas now. So if there's any further contributions you can make, ladies and gentlemen, into the so I can actually have like a holiday and be able to recharge my batteries without worrying about whether or not I can eat during the holidays, that would be really lovely. Please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and make a donation or start up an automatic payment of as little as $5 a month today. And we're also in need of a new vehicle. So, if there's any possibility, anybody listening from New Zealand who could help us out in that regard by either donating a vehicle or selling it to us on the cheap or something of that nature, you can check out the contact page on the homepage of the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you again sometime.